Hey friends, thank you all so much for tuning in to this episode, which is officially episode 10 of Healing the Divide podcast. So we are in the double digits. I am so excited for this episode. Today we're sitting down with Tawny Lyons, and Tawny is a psychotherapist specializing in embodiment and somatics. She guides individuals to connect with themselves and others compassionately. She believes in the transformative power of relationships of all kinds and finding expansion through intentional inner and interconnection, embracing life's cosmic humor through love, nature, writing, art, and playfulness. Thank you so much for being here, Tawny.
Thank you, Scott. I'm so excited to meet with you.
Yeah, same. So for our listeners, Tawny and I connected through Instagram, and I felt such an impact from her page, so from your page. So thank you, thank you, thank you. It's not always that we encounter other accounts where there feels like there's such resonance and value being shared. I want to just acknowledge a couple of traits that have felt so powerful to me is first and foremost a sense of what I guess I would call wise vulnerability. Not just like a spilling out of vulnerability, but a sharing of vulnerability in a way that communicates something that feels valuable and offering and helpful and healing. And then the other piece is empathic attunement, that there's a sense of tuning into the relational field and bringing curiosity and skillfulness to it. And so I'm just so excited for today. I've kind of sat with it this morning before recording and thought about what is this really about? And my hope is, first and foremost, as we just spoke about a few minutes ago, not having a conversation that feels like so incredibly structured that it feels rigid and prescribed, but more that there's spaces to explore and unpack and see what comes out of it, with the hope that by listening or viewing this episode, that people can find some really powerful trauma healing tools that they can get into some maybe deeper support with embodiment practices, especially in the space of deeper intimacy. And I love that you wrote in your bio of your work, the interconnection and the interconnection. So I really see intimacy as existing relationally, within ourselves in order to have it come out, but also how the external informs the internal. I want to parse all that detail out. I want to get into attachment theory, even if we're at like the 30,000 foot view to start, and then see where it takes, because it's been such a helpful exploration tool for me to really understand the patterns that are at play in my life, and looking also at sexuality, not only as intimacy in terms of the relationship, but the larger idea of identity and sexuality and the changing structures of relationships that are based on those identities as our society is evolving to varying degrees of embrace, and how that informs a larger ripple effect of concepts like the divine masculine and divine feminine, how they imprint on the nervous system, interact with one another, sort of within these varying structural identities. I want to get into a little bit of Dharma, some insight practices, some spirituality, yoga, meditation, philosophy, kind of moving from the tools to support self-regulation to kind of bring us online, but then like to really move some momentum into the like from regulation to liberation. And like, what is the deeper meaning of this incarnation? Who am I really? How does that inform how I show up in this life? So I have lots of questions. It's the long and the short of it. And I'm grateful for the opportunity to dive in with you.
Yeah, I'm grateful too. And I just want to say, I so appreciate your intentionality. I feel like it just drops me into the present moment really fully.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you so much. I think that's the key. And I think, and I don't know how you hold this, but being a therapist and just being a human, being in relationships, like we don't have to do it perfectly. Like it's gonna get messy. We're gonna, there's like it's okay for there to be rupture. We can have tools for repair. And I think that intention is like the grace that it's like, oh, okay, that'll probably come up like during this conversation. I'll probably say things from a seat of unknowing and ignorance, not in a judgmental way, but I'm open to that. So I just want to share, like I come in like open and humble, and the intention is firm. The form will probably scatter into different expressions, and so yeah. So thank you for presencing that. And is there anything you'd want to add to the mix for intention?
For an intention. I mean, I feel like just the one that comes up for me in this moment is just beginner's mind and curiosity. Especially when it comes to theories, I think sometimes it can be helpful for me to remember that nuance is so important. And I'm also just excited to get to know more about you too.
Cool, thank you. Yeah, same. So let's dive in. I'd love to open the conversation up with our understanding of the human condition, because that feels like it's the elephant in the room of life, of like the three-dimensional reality. But specifically, the human condition as related to relational experience. So, like, how do you see our hardwiring as a species, our biological predisposition in regards to our basic and primary need for connection and belonging?
Oh, what an amazing question.
Yeah, take
I
your time.
mean, yeah, I have a hard time answering those kinds of questions because I notice my limitations being a clinician and, a mystic or whatever I want to call it, just a fallible human. I'm not a biologist. And so, like the nature versus nurture question comes up so much in my own work around sexuality and what it means to be a woman or a man or a non-binary person. And just I recognize my own limitations around understanding. And I think as humans, we have some limitations, a lot of limitations around understanding the nature part. And so my own idea or hope or felt sense of it. And also what I know from attachment science is that we need safety, that felt sense of safety with others. And we need to feel like we belong. We need to feel attunement. We need to feel like we're seen and we're known and we're valued and we're delighted in. And community is really important. Right now in this moment, I'm just noticing sadness around maybe the lack of that for many people, and how that can create insecure attachment or feeling insecurely attached to ourselves, to our higher selves, to nature, the universe, God, whatever you want to call it, and to each other. And so it feels really central to me, my work.
Yeah, I think it's incredible when we can encounter clinicians that aren't overtly sterile in the sort of analysis of the situation. So I appreciate, again, this is kind of what I was speaking to with the empathic attunement, that there's a heart resonance to I'm interpreting what's happening, not cognition, but really through like heart wisdom and feeling and tuning. And so to have a sense of empathy for that, there are so many people that feel excluded, and then so often it feels like that almost gets caught in a feedback loop where then we internalize that about ourselves, and then we start to exile off aspects of our own nature. And so, you know, to go to like parts work, there's like these at least seemingly fragmented aspects of our nature that we regard as such. And so it feels like to me that, I don't know how it's been for you, but like in my own journey, that there was a while where I had the belief that like, I better do that work before I can come into a relationship, so I don't bring all this brokenness with me. And what I have learned that I'm so grateful for is that it's almost been the opposite, that if I'm in a healthy relationship where there is willingness and wantingness and capacity present, where there's compassion and curiosity present, there's space to do that healing work. It's almost as if, because the wounds are relational, the healing is too. And so I'm wondering, from your view as somebody that works with people in this space, if your experience has confirmed that, or shown something different.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely, in some ways, in many cases, confirmed for sure that people are worried. Some people, I feel like it depends on our attachment strategies and whatever else, like whether I feel like I need to be perfect before I'm in a relationship, or the other person needs to be perfect, you know?
Yeah.
And sometimes it's a bit of both, you know, but I so agree with you 100% that bringing our broken parts, if we're to call it that, into relationship. And I think John Wellwood, who wrote Conscious Loving, he was a psychologist, and he talked about relationships like charnel ground, which my understanding of charnel ground is where you go to pray, where there's dead bodies around you. And it's just like this really, I have not done it in India, but this really enlivening, but also remembering that you're going to die kind of experience. It's everything. It's not just good and it's not just bad, you know, and that's always really struck with me, because I feel like that is what we're here to do. I don't think that relationships can, or even quote unquote should be clean or something, like, you know, be able to be wrapped with a bow. And there's this idea on social media, I think, that, and even sometimes just in, you know, pop psychology, of everything is toxic, or somebody's a narcissist or has borderline personality disorder or whatever it is. And so get them out of your life, cut them out, fix yourself, focus on yourself. And I just think that we're losing so much of ourselves, like you said, you know, that we've kind of cast aside or cut off when we do that, not just cutting off other people, but also parts of ourselves. And so, yeah, I just think there's something really magical and transformative when we can be willing to be messy.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It reminds me of soul retrieval work, in the sense of like, we're going and kind of mining for the parts that have felt compartmentalized and hidden. And it's interesting with the charnel ground. I was just reading about this in my yogic studies, that the early roots of Tantra this was a practice. And so they would go to the cemeteries, they would dance, pray, sing, meditate. They would actually take even ashes of dead loved ones and rub it on their bodies. And it was all about like coming into the full dynamic expression of all aspects of life. And this ton, this root, is funny because it almost is in your name. But it the word tense comes from this, and that there's like a tensile nature of stretching to include all aspects of self versus just the transcendent or just the immanent. And it's just so profound. And actually the physical practices, the hatha yoga practices, emerged out of these philosophical worldviews that said we want to include the body. And I think it's fascinating that we're talking about like trauma therapy, somatics, because so often, you know, just like in like the pop psychology that you mentioned, everybody's ex is a narcissist. And, you know, it's like, come on, guys. Like we can turn towards these challenging parts and bring them in, and they're all welcome. And it doesn't mean that we want to condone everything. And that's actually one of my questions I have for you in a little while, is about like working with like self-advocacy and boundary setting and managing that space. But to the point of like as we start to step into an actual comprehension of somatics, one of the pop yoga things that came about, there's watching its evolution, has been like for like at some level, first it's like it's all about the asana practice, right? And then the next level is like this thought that's like, well, it's not about the asana practice, that's just the superficial, that's the surface, it's this deeper dimension. And then if you keep digging far enough and you get to like the real roots of trauma work and how healing happens, it has to include the body. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, well, guess what, asana is like ancient somatic healing. And, you know, you pick up the Yoga Sutras which was pre-asana, but it defines yoga as yoga's cessation of identification with the fluctuations of consciousness. And those fluctuations are sort of the imprints into our neural pathways. And so all of a sudden it's like, well, we're sitting on ancient neuroscience that's including the body, and we're just discovering the depth of it. And I think, to your point, it's like the things that we sort of like bandy about, when we deprive the conversation of nuance, we miss the deeper intentionality of it, and the deeper possibility that lives within these spaces. And it's kind of why I like doing this in long form, because we can parse it out and you know, go deeper than the talking points or the real, you know.
Yes, like, instead of the five major things we can do to heal our trauma, 14 weeks to heal your attachment.
Yeah, there's always a set of numbers, right?
I think it's a thing. Yeah.
It is.
Weird, probably brains are into that or something.
I laugh because I was thinking about this recently, and it's like, if I were going to number something, I would definitely, it would be like principles over process. And this idea of these linear, you know what I mean? Like it's describing yesterday, we were in our teacher training, and we're talking about like we don't ungrow, but we don't grow in a linear way. So I was like, it kind of looks like this. And I stand on one side of the room and I start like spinning in circles and walking everywhere and zigzagging. But as I'm doing it, I'm making my way across the room.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that so much. It reminds me of the, I think it was you were saying the tantric image or something of accepting all of it. It reminds me of that, that non-linear acceptance and invitation into growth that doesn't look a certain way.
So in that sense, if we could wrap these ideas together and we were to use or perceive in this moment relationship, and when in this sense, I mean like, intimate relationship in whatever form that takes, what do you view as like the, maybe it's like the most sacred or primary function of relationship?
The most primary or sacred function of relationship. I don't know that it's the most sacred, but I feel like the most primary, if our hope, our aim, our goal is to have security and connection, then I imagine that it's the mutual devotion or commitment or intention or wanting even of that same goal with at least two people of security. Because if that goal isn't shared, like if I were to go to somebody and say, hey, I really want to create this relationship and I want it to look like a secure, functioning, attachment-based relationship. If that person doesn't share in that goal, then we're going to be constantly debating and fighting about the foundation that we're on. Yeah, exactly like what you just did with your hands. So it's like, it's not going to be able to be co-created, at least not in the way that I would hope for it to be. Something's going to be co-created, and maybe it'd be even, really wonderful. But if that's my aim, I really think that being in the same, or at least looking in the same direction, or hope of the same direction. And I kind of get that from a meditation teacher. I don't know if you've heard or know of George Haas, but he teaches metta meditation in Los Angeles and virtually, and he infuses a lot of attachment science into it. He worked with Daniel P. Brown, who is at Harvard, utilizing active imagination and meditation to help rewire into secure functioning attachment. And I remember him in one of his talks saying, if you want a secure relationship, only date people who also want that. And that sounds very black and white, sure, but it's also, I think, can be really transformative. And not just, do you want that and I want that? Because somebody might say no when what they're actually wanting is yes. So getting into the more of the long form too of understanding, what is it that you want to co-create here? What is, how do you want to feel? What do you want to heal?
That's funny that that's how you closed it, because I was going to say, I hear inside of it, what do you want to heal?
Yeah.
That's it feels to me, and this again is not a heady angle towards it. I'm just kind of feeling into my own version of that, and it's like we get to heal the parts that felt unlovable, insecure, unworthy, not capable, those core wounds. There's something so beautiful, and then bringing it up into like the effulgence of joy and shared play, and how important that bonding and expression is. But it's so beautiful to me, and it feels like there's this idea that is that like those, like I don't want to show those parts in so many people. It's like those, if I were to show you this, this would make me unlovable. And when we're mirrored back by a partner that says, no, actually, I understand why you would feel that way, and the courage that it takes to display that and bring it out into the open doesn't tell me that you're insecure. It tells me that you're courageous, and I have those parts too. Will you support me in loving them, and I'll love those parts in you, and support me in reminding me to love my own? And there's this mutual reciprocity that emerges when we can get to that shared value that you speak to of finding secure attachment. So I think for our viewers and listeners that might be new to attachment theory, and especially for people that might have followed me that or like just that I might know personally from the realm of yoga, the word attachment's tricky, right? Because in two different
None
spaces
of
it really means
that.
different things. Yeah, there's like the value of, in the yoga dharma, it's called vairagya, means non-attachment, and it's like the core of not being attached to the identification with the produced or manifest aspects of learned identity. And that can be so bypassing. We can, if we're enmeshed in all these aspects and we've never considered that we're more than that, it's as if our emotions will tell us, who we are rather than how we are. If we get trapped in identities of whether it's like gender identity or ethnicity or profession, like it can keep us trapped, but yet also denying those things is also a trap. And so it's such a razor's edge of how we can create space to hold aspects of our experience without being defined in sum total by them, and then recognizing that from that non-attachment of identity, what the in attachment theory, if I'm understanding correctly, and I'm excited to hear what you have to say, that the attachment really is like secure connection, the deep
Yes.
root that our needs are being met. So I was wondering if you could just parse out maybe the difference of the use of the word attachment, and then maybe use that as a launch pad to if you were going to introduce what attachment theory is to people that might be new to it.
First of all, I really appreciate you talking about the attachment piece because it's interesting. Before I explain what it is, it does seem like we get attached to attachment theory or attached to pathology too. And I think just holding it with spaciousness, allowing it to help us understand ourselves, but not being so married to it that we don't understand, okay, we're also more than this. So
The
with
nuance.
that being said, the nuance, the necessary nuance, the multiplicity of being alive. But I do love attachment theory. I think it would be great if it was called connection theory or security theory. But basically how it goes is the creator of it was John Bowlby, and he was a in the 1950s, he created this based on working with children and noticing patterns of behaviors in them with their caretakers, and wanting to see if how we raise children actually impacts them, which is interesting to even say that, but it's true. And this was the 1950s, it wasn't that long ago. I know, right? But yeah, so basically what came of that is understanding that there are different patterns or strategies, based on the way that a little one was raised on how they would respond to a parent. So later, Mary Maine did more research on it to understand it more. And she did it by seeing what happens when parents leave a room when a kid is there with toys, and then a stranger coming in and a stranger leaving. So basically, they began to understand that there are actually three different subtypes of what is called insecure attachment, when somebody does not, or rather a child doesn't connect securely with a caretaker or to the world or to themselves. And the three insecure subtypes are anxious, which is sometimes called preoccupied, avoidant, which is called dismissive sometimes, and then disorganized, which is sometimes called fearful avoidant. And they noticed how the anxious child would be very preoccupied with the connection of their mom, specifically leaving the room, and wouldn't be able to play with toys, but would have protest behaviors when the mom came back of like, I'm so angry and I'm so fussy and why did you leave me? Like that kind of thing. They couldn't speak. They were really little, but just kind of noticing that. An avoidant child, on the other hand, would act like it didn't matter. Would act like it didn't matter. And that's a really important feature because, they really do. And I just want to put a little asterisk here saying that later research has shown that avoidant children actually have higher cortisol and stress levels happening inside of their bodies than even the anxious, but they're
That
not presenting like that. So fascinating because they've learned mom or dad or whoever is not going to be there for me. So I need to just shut down my attachment behavioral system, but there's still this yearning. And I think that's really important for the nuance and empathy around that kind of strategy, the avoidant. And then the disorganized is where there's either, oftentimes people will say there's abuse. It doesn't have to be abuse. It could be, and often is, the parent's own insecure attachment and disorganized attachment, their own trauma, addiction, or just working a lot, and the child learning basically that pain and connection are wired together. And then if 70% of the time, if 70% of the time a child gets the five pillars of secure attachment, which are, and I have them here because me being able to say it randomly would be tough for my ADHD brain, is a felt sense of safety, so consistently feeling protected, feeling seen and known, which is called attunement, a sense of comfort, so that soothing and reassurance, feeling valued, so having caretakers express delight, and then support for exploration. So encouraged and interested in the inner exploration, like what you feel, and also the outer exploration. If 70% of the time I get that, so more than half, then I will have secure functioning attachment, which makes it easier for me to, or anyone, to have like a flourishing life in every area. This isn't just related to relationships, although I think everything's a relationship, but also work and creation and whatever else that we do in life.
Absolutely. So it's really pervasive in how we orient to safety in all situations.
Yes,
And
exactly.
fascinating that it is that it was the 1950s by the time we figured out that our parental relationships might have a deep impact on our psychological development. And so
Well, from the
can I ask,
scientific perspective,
right?
Western science, right?
Yes. I'm going to say there are
Grateful,
some
grateful for
philosophies
what's
that were
in.
aware of this. So thank you so much for the elucidation, because in particular, the disorganized has always felt a little disorganized for me. It's like a lot of what I see and consume through social media, there's so much emphasis on anxious avoidant and the various, interplays. And I was, is disorganized like an intensified anxious? But then you called it the fearful avoidant. And I think this might be the first time it's really clarifying itself for me, which is the wiring together, if I heard you correctly, of can you remind me of the words that you used, the wiring
I
together?
can't remember exactly which words, but fear and connection, basically, or
Fear.
intimacy, closeness, and fear.
So really, does it keep us almost in this like feedback loop of like come close, push away, and
Exactly. That's exactly what I was going to say. Yeah.
okay,
Come here, go away.
got you. Yeah, and for those of us listening, there's one hand open like give me space, and another one that's like saying come close, come close. And then what happens? The interplay between all the different patterns. So I'm just thinking of in my own space the things I've experienced where I tend probably closer to avoidant, I would say. And so it can look as though I'm almost like stoic, but I'm at, and like and so my partner could be like, where are you? What's happening? Are you shut down? And or not like not are you shut down, but like do you not care? Like can you show something? And I'm like, I feel so much, I'm going to explode, but I can look like so steady and blank. And I think sometimes I feel like misinterpreted, not necessarily from her, because now she knows that, but like as a human in general, moving through life, that I was even having a conversation with my father recently, and he's like, are you doing okay? You never look stressed. You always like everything's like, so even. And I'm like, well, it's just because that's how I internalize to meet my need, and I don't represent it outwardly as much. So I'm learning how to turn towards those parts, and because they will internally get defensive, and so to learn how to self-soothe and remind those parts of me that like the experience that I am interpreting that I'm having from past experience is not this experience. And I don't know if this works within your system of approach, but I tend to imagine that from my ground of being, in yoga talk, that would be like called Purusha, it's like your soul or your spirit self, that I'm letting the little me's co-regulate to soul self by
That's beautiful.
offering my own ground, like lending ground when it's available. And then like when it's not, having literal like a literal list of somatic tools that I can keep on my phone, so the only thing I have to remember is like open phone, because it can feel inaccessible in those moments.
Absolutely. Yeah,
So
there's that's wonderful that you I love that you're how you experience that and conceptualize it. It sounds like, yeah, like co-regulation with the soul parts or the wise parts of you within you. I feel really impacted by that. Yeah, so it doesn't sound isolating.
Yeah, the other, like on that note, that thread, I found this and to be true. So I would open this dialogue, start communicating, and I can feel even now as we're talking, and I can speak about this, if not directly to those parts, that they feel so like young. And when the conversation ends, there would historically be like, okay, so great talk. Peace, I'm out. Off to the next thing. And then there's this little kid who's like, you just reinforced the pain. So I started to make this process of like, do you want to come with me? And so
My
now I
gosh,
move
that's
through
so
the
touching.
day. Yeah, like I'm like, well, come with me. And that's been the most healing part, more than the actual dialogue, is this part of me seeing the world for the first time. Like, because a lot of my wounding comes back to like, I can remember like my parents fighting and like hiding in my closet under a pile of clothes. And so like I always visualize, I'm like, come out of the closet and walk around, and I'm like holding Xander
Yeah,
through
I'll
life
hold
in that
you.
way. So if energy gets big around me, instead of like into that avoidant cave of clothes on the closet floor, it's like, I got you. You're safe. We're breathing. This is not that. And if it gets to be too much, we can express that. So I started implementing this tool on the front end of like, instead of actually shutting down, giving voice to the tendency on its way up that arc of the trigger, where there's enough capacity still present to say something like, I can feel myself wanting to shut down.
Yes. So powerful. Oh, yeah. You can just begin to feel those inklings, and then you can voice it either for yourself or with a partner or a loved one.
Yeah, this is getting
Yes.
scary. This is feel I want to run. I can feel myself want to yell. Like, whatever, can we give voice to it while it's in its like embryonic form? So I guess that's kind of like a space I'd love to explore a little bit with you if you're open. Is like, what are some of the maybe primary patterns that you have seen in terms of the different insecure attachment styles interacting with each other?
I mean, the big one that I feel like most people have heard or experienced is that kind of push-pull dynamic, where one person is taking on the position of more of the anxiousness and one person is taking on the position of more of the avoidance. And then it's interesting because the disorganized positioning actually feels like that whole system, but inside of that one person, if that makes sense, like the push-pull on the inside of one person.
That's so clarifying. Thank you. Yes. So can we go slow here? Because I could feel like it, like my mind wants to get,
I love that you just asked that too, because I'll just keep flitting around.
No, well, to the point of like saying the thing, right? So let's look at each one, maybe, if that feels okay. And so in the anxious avoidant dynamic.
It's a little tough to for me to express just like in general because it presents so differently in my experience based on the people. And that feels really important to say because I think often what happens is somebody will be like, well, I'm avoidant or I'm anxious or I'm disorganized. And although I imagine there's truth in that feeling, that I really like to look at it instead like the strategy that comes up in a relationship at a certain time. So if I'm in a relationship with my partner, sometimes I might be the anxious one, but sometimes I might be the avoidant one. And so looking at the strategy itself of maybe asking, am I trying to protect myself or am I trying to connect right now? And then if I'm trying to protect, am I doing it in a way by blaming them? Because sometimes that louder blame is the anxious. Like, what's wrong with you? When really there's probably a need in that moment to ask myself, what's wrong with me right now? But there could be that external projection of, I know with a partner of mine, I would often ask him, are you okay? And that would really bother him. And I didn't even realize that it was a negative thing. They'd be like, "Are you okay?" Because I was trying to read the room to be safe in myself. But instead of saying, "Hey, I'm feeling this way," and checking in, I would project it onto him and ask him what's wrong, which is kind of creating turbulence and saying, "There's something wrong with you," which could create a shame response. So that situation could be understood as my anxiousness showing up, my preoccupation of, is this situation okay so I can be okay?
So in that scenario, I can definitely relate to both people, and I can find times when I've been both, to your point, that and just as a quick aside, a lot of the work I do utilizes the tool of Enneagram, and I see a similar tendency, ironic attachment tendency in the not in the attachment theory, but the yogic type of attachment, where we say, "I am a five," or "I'm a withdrawal type," or "I'm an assertive type," and we self-identify as it rather than saying, like, my personality kind of tells me how I essentially come into my, like, what I'm not, into my learning. So I don't want to self-identify as, well, I'm avoidant. So I want to look at it as, I can feel the tendency to become avoidant showing up here.
Yes, that feels just so relieving to me to hear. Yeah, because I think, yeah, if I'm like, well, I'm anxious or I'm avoidant, I'm then creating my own reality, and it feels kind of calcifying to me or rigid.
Absolutely. It's like it reinforces the illusion while you're trying to overcome the identification as it. It subtly keeps you entrenched in that story. So that said, I can definitely understand that, like, sort of probing for, like, "Are you okay?" And then it's like, "Wait, what do you mean? What's wrong?" And then you start to, like, assess inside, and it feels like somebody's like, yeah, like kind of like it feels probey, and then this defensiveness can come up out of it.
I'm
So
like pulling my
really,
coat closer. I'm like, get away from me.
so like really the asking for reassurance, it seems like the medicine then, where we can say, this is, so I'm owning what I'm feeling. So and this is what I need. I just, ironically, it's a fun conversation. I hope that my partner is comfortable with this. I think so, because she shared we should do a podcast about our process. So this
I
morning
love
she
that.
said something to me. I thought it was really lovely. She said, "I want to ask you for reassurance about something, but can you not go with like swift immediacy to, I just did that?" Because, and this is gets into the nuance a little bit, because I could feel the thing that she was asking me for reassurance around, I actually did in the objective, literal sense, just express something that from my perspective would demonstrate the need being met, which is like, I value, I want to spend time, all these things. But I think what happens is sometimes for the avoidant person that can become defensive, and please correct me if I'm off here, but what it feels like in my own being is, it feels like when reassurance is being asked for, that a flaw is being pointed out. Like if you're asking me for something, that must mean that you don't feel like you're getting it, and that must be like point to some deficiency in me. So I then turn towards it and I check for like accountability, and then I defend and go, "Well, no, I just told you that at that this is important to me and I want to do this." And now we're not even addressing the original need for reassurance, which might have nothing to do with what I'm sending, but everything to do with what they're receiving. Maybe they didn't hear it. Maybe they're in a different space. Maybe they need to hear it in a different way, or they need to hear it again. Or they, and so I know for me, there's a learning and a growing into the willingness to offer reassurance without feeling that it's somehow exposing some unlovable flaw within my own self, which then blocks the person from receiving what they really need that they're asking for, and blocks one's own self from feeling that all parts of them are valid and they're not under attack.
And I think though there's also something when I hear you say that that's really beautiful about it sounds like you value integrity. You know, like, oh wait, did I do this? Did I actually ch checking for the logic of it when oftentimes it's an emotional bid for connection and reassurance instead of the logical, factual thing. Like, you know, what could be seen by a camera instead of what could be kind of felt on the inside.
100%.
And I also think, you know, just as much as the avoidance strategies work in that moment is to share more of their heart potentially. It can also be the anxious strategy in those moments to tend to their own hearts too and give reassurance. Like I've known clients and I've done this myself too of having notes in their phone, whether they're monogamous or polyamorous or whatever, because it can become more complex of actual data. Like the logical part of why this person cares for me, what they've done, maybe like screenshots of text or whatever to come back. Because sometimes, and I don't mean to say your partner, but just in general, sometimes when that reassurance need is coming up multiple times, the soothing may need to come from within because it might be re more related to their story of when they were little and needing their parents and what they did in that moment.
Absolutely. Thank you for the subtle parsing out of that space. I think there is the like cultivation of our own container and realizing like what is our own work and what we're asking for from another. And I think one of the tools that we've implemented that I found to be so beneficial is in this particular dynamic is leading with this may or may not be true. I might be in a story. This might be coming from like my personality. You didn't do anything wrong, and I'm not going anywhere. And if I can hear those, and then I'm like, oh, whatever you need, I'm like all in, I'm online, nothing gets dysregulated. So there's something about learning to lead those things, and then in a very loving way, instead of like throwing it back in the other person's face and saying, this is, which I'm gonna like, hold myself accountable for this, and in the growth work that I've had to do in my own being has been not to just go, hey, so I would recognize there would be the cognition that this isn't my work, this is your work, but I could feel because it felt so threatening to that avoidant energy, wanting to kind of put it back in their face a little, not like in a judgment way, but like, this isn't my
This isn't
responsibility, this
mine.
is yours. And it would feel so like, ugh, to be on the other side of that, I imagine. So I think there's like how would you guide the loving way to say, this is yours?
I mean, how I'm envisioning it is also some amount of the yearning to do work from the other side, which I hear from you too, of like, you know, I don't know exactly how I would say it, for instance, maybe like, you know, I wonder if this is something coming up from experiences before me, but I'm here to work through this with you and I want to see what parts in this, you know, might be triggering me too. I don't want to be just in a defensive position, but I'm noticing I don't know how much of this is about me.
Dear listeners, please notice it's 49 minutes into the podcast. Please screenshot, clip, record that, and save it in your favorites for when I'm sure to listen to. Yeah, thank you, world, for coming to my therapy session. That was, thank you. I just need to actually let it absorb for a moment because that felt so medicinal. I'm glad we're getting into these more granular spaces of
Yeah,
interaction. So I feel like that was
me
a
too.
beautiful representation of getting, I know we can't get into all scenarios and possibilities and to somewhere between like uber specific on everything and being like super general, that I feel like we did a like good job of giving an example of the anxious attachment and what some of the patterning could look like. Could we go to another one? Like, for example, maybe go to like anxious and disorganized.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. So the anxious, I feel like the example of are you okay actually comes up clinically too. And so I wonder, like, how about going into that one more? Does that feel okay?
Yeah.
So in those moments, you know, whatever the person is asking that's feeling anxious on the inside, it could be, are you upset? Are you mad at me is one that comes up a lot. Are you mad at me? Are you okay? But there's this kind of prying in a way from the receiver's end of it, even maybe if they are secure functioning in that dynamic. And on the inside, what's really interesting from what I've heard is it feels invitational to be asking that. It feels really loving, like palms open, like, are you okay? Like, I'm here. And I feel like that's really interesting to hear, because from the other end, it feels invasive for many people. You know, like, even though I've asked that in a partnership where sometimes I'm more anxious with him, when he's asked me that, or when other partners have asked me, or friends or whatever have asked me, are you okay right now? It feels like, what do you need from me? like, why are you asking that? What's wrong with you? You know, there's like, and I also just, like, as we're laughing here, I think humor can actually be really helpful if that's what you use in your own relationship. It is in mine. To be able to not take ourselves so seriously with this.
Right.
You know, like to have a little bit, like, for instance, with that one partner, one time he really did say, is there something wrong with you? And it was very sassy response, you know, like that. But it like kind of shook me a little bit, which sometimes somatically might be needed, is kind of maybe more of that trickster energy, not all the time, because that can feel unsafe. But I think, you know, especially if we're in that rigid place of like, there's something wrong with this other person, which I think in my experience is what is happening a lot of the time with the anxious presentation, is something's wrong with the other person, but I'm good. Which actually nuance needed here too, because the avoidant can present that way too, of I'm the secure one, there's something wrong with you. So always, there's always an invitation, I guess, to look inward and see what is really happening. But I think in the anxious position, when that question is being asked out, I think of arms reaching out and needing a lot of reassurance. Mm-hmm. And the image that I have in response to that is reaching the arms back inward to check in with your own heart first. Mm-hmm. Even if you've already asked it, you know, of just first being like, wait, actually, I want to check in to see what parts, my inner parts, my little ones might be needing in this moment, you know. Oh, okay. We haven't been talking every day for a week. And so I'm starting to feel, you know, my attachment need, my connection need rather with you is filling up. And I would like to ask for some reassurance around that or whatever it may be, but really seeing what the specific things that are making me feel anxious and prickly and on guard are, so I can own that for myself and feel more empowered.
It's just like, wouldn't it be amazing if this was a subject in school that we learned as children? We were all had this emotional intelligence. So are there, maybe I'll offer it up this way. Are there any other ones that you see in terms of the interactions amongst the different types that you feel called to highlight that are probably more common for people?
I mean, across the board, blaming is a really big one. I think no matter what the adaptation is. And I think, you know, there's that old state adage or something that's like, you know, when there's one point finger pointed outward, there's three pointed or four pointed back at you or whatever, whatever that may be. And I think just any time we want to focus on another person, to first check in with oneself is a really wonderful way to take steps towards security. Not to say that the other person shouldn't be accountable, but just first getting more clear on what's really happening inside.
I was describing this in the session earlier today, actually, with someone. So I'm glad that you presenced this. And I would be curious how you hold this. I was describing it as a double-edged arrow, where the arrow pointing out is blame, and the arrow pointing in is shame. And we tend to vacillate and think that, if I'm feeling blamed, and then I'm blaming you for blaming me, and then I realize that I've done that, then I shame me for doing that, and I can't get out of that loop. And it's like a self-referring feedback loop. And I think, okay, so this would be my own like comprehension of this dynamic, and I want to unpack this a little bit if we can. That it feels like maybe this is the logical part of my brain says maybe this is happening because when I realize that I have like what I've been up to in terms of blaming you, it feels like the opposite of that. It feels like going back to that accountability piece is I shouldn't have blamed you. I should blame me. That it actually feels that's so funny. Whatever the Zoom
What just
thing is.
happened?
I don't know, but it's so funny for people watching. There's these things like they're on like FaceTime, but even though on Zoom, they do it now, where like you put your hands up or something and it like puts a thumbs up. It just did literally did like
Was
fourth
like
of
mic drop fireworks for you when you said
It's so awesome.
that.
I am blaming me. We have the big insight coming. So the opposite would be like not blaming you versus blaming me, but putting that arrow down and picking up the opposite of a shame blame dynamic altogether, which would be like an acceptance, validation, empathy dynamic, thing dynamic. And so then I go, so I start with the template of removing fault and blame. So if I'm in any sort of conflict arising energy, one of the first questions to ask is, how would this look through a lens that was absent of any fault or blame? If nobody's wrong and nobody's
Love that.
attacking, it's like, oh, so okay, you're not blaming me, you're hurting, or you're asking for clarification, or maybe you're just sharing how you feel. And this would be something I would love to hear your thoughts on is sometimes like we do need to be able to hear our partners say, this isn't working for me, or I need this part to be different. Like it's not it I'm gonna say it's not a criticism, but it is a request. And how can we help people to receive a request absent of the filter of criticism?
I mean, there's so much there. I feel like there's all these different modalities that are literally flashing through my head right now. Like, well, that reminds me of this and this and this. I have to come back to this moment. I mean, I think, you know, I don't know if you've ever seen that quote or meme that's knowing your partner's love language or knowing your partner's triggers is a love language. And that's what I'm reminded of in this moment. It's just like when you were saying those statements before, when your partner say like, when she says like, I'm not going to leave you, or I'm not blaming you, or I can't remember exactly what they were, but there was a series of statements that you need to hear before, almost like a shit sandwich, if you've ever heard of that negative, positive, negative sort of
Yeah, I will
situation.
literally say like I'm gonna sandwich you right now.
Sandwich you.
Yeah.
I love that. I mean, I think that that's honestly the best way to do it, because if we were looking at it from a different perspective in nonviolent communication, If I'm triggered, I need my own self-empathy before I can empathize with you. You know? So giving you the sandwich is you're triggered, most likely. I'm triggered, most likely, if we're in that place where we need to give each other intense feedback, or at least a little bit activated. So being able to let you know you're safe, I care about you, I love you, this is why I'm giving you this information, is going to help you to be able to hear it. Otherwise, you know, our swords are going to be up, and that makes sense.
Right. Yes. Thank you. How that felt in me was it moved it from, like, right now, if I'm sitting in my chair and you're coming through the computer screen in front of me versus on the computer screen, the images of us are side by side. And so it feels like if I could put that into relational dynamic, instead of swords up facing each other where the conflict exists between us, we sit down next to one another.
Yeah.
And then the challenge is in front of us and we're sharing our respective experiences and needs around it.
Yes. As a team. Yeah, I'm so glad that you just brought imagery in there, because that's so resonant with what I was feeling, and actually very resonant with what I was feeling when you were speaking to the arrow of blame and shame too, of like blame or grandiosity and shame being in different positions, like maybe one is above and one is below. So instead of the sword image, it's the position of a higher chair and a lower chair. So if we can put our chairs where we meet, where we see each other eye to eye and recognize, oh, we're on the same team. I'm not needing to fight to be better than you, or, you know, the opposite. It's like we're on the same team. Nobody's wrong. And can we feel that? Can we have a felt sense of we're in this together?
I love that so much. Yeah, I hadn't thought of it that way. I was visualizing the arrow just sort of like on a horizontal plane. So that was helpful to see it on that that level of like, it does feel hierarchical. Where you draw in that like grandiosity or like the bottom of the pit energy of shame that can feel so awful. Yeah. So what about when these are relational dynamics, not between humans, but when it like outsources to things? So like, for example, let's say achievement. Is that talked about in attachment theory? Like I actually have anxious attachment around my sense of, let's say, success.
Yes. I mean, I haven't read it in a lot of the literature, but there has been some, like, for instance, Jessica Fern talks about the nested model of attachment. So much like those Russian dolls where the small one fits inside the larger ones. We can look at that like our relationship to our partner, our friends, and then outward from there, our communities, our culture, nature. And she talks about it in terms of having secure attachment with different things, but also there's insecure attachment. Like, for instance, we're going through climate change right now, and there's a lot happening politically. I think it's really interesting that you asked about achievement, because that's really important too. That might be a feature of something like capitalism. And so then maybe. So getting curious about that. Yeah.
This last podcast I did, we were talking about colonialism and we were looking at different societal structures. We were comparing like anarchism, capitalism, socialism, and communism. And then it evolved into a little piece around the colonization of consciousness that exists within those varying structures and frameworks, and how it's such a blind spot. So I deeply, deeply appreciate you presencing that in, you know, I love Ken Wilber's integral theory work. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with this, but it's like in that collective unconsciousness of, say, living in a capitalistic structure, it would be lauded to have high degrees of achievement. And then if we're coming into those structures and developing self-identity on the like the internal at the individual level, and we're self-referencing to this, you know, this ideal that we inherited, in a sense that it's like, what am I carrying in terms of values and ideals that was just pure indoctrination? And there are systems that I've been studying lately that are aware of that, but take the opposite view and say, well, the society existed prior to you, and so your role and function is to conform to what the society is and like contribute to it. And I feel like that's so painful. Talk about being excluded. And it's like, and so, yeah, I would love to hear, maybe just like extrapolate a little bit more on that piece. Maybe we can connect it to just threading the achievement within capitalism.
Yeah.
If there's more, if you have more to share.
Yeah. Let me think about that. So when I was thinking about capitalism, I actually wasn't just thinking about capitalism, but more of the dominator culture large, like whatever we were to call it, like often called patriarchy or whatever, but I'd see it more as the energies. And sometimes I feel like patriarchy or capitalism has so many connotations to it that aren't necessarily, we might not be talking about the same thing. I don't know if you've ever found.
Yeah, it's that. Loaded. Is it maybe more like oppressor, oppressed, or dominator, oppressor?
Yeah, or... I definitely like, yeah, like the dominator culture idea, because yeah. Mm-hmm. I think the first time I heard that was from Rhian Eisler. I really appreciate her work around it. But so when I think about achievement in a dominator culture, the dominator is the one that's on the top. So if we're thinking about blaming, they're the ones who are shaming the other people, basically. Mm. And so if I want to be a part of, if I want to belong, if I want to feel security and safety, then I need to be the dominator. And so if I achieve, I'll get there. But if not, I'll just be shame.
Right. And so how, because your true nature, that's antithetical to our true nature.
Yes.
Being more, I don't know if you work with plant medicine at all or anything like that. But recently I was in an ayahuasca ceremony and I had this profound insight. Or I don't want to call it an insight because it felt, that sells it short. This felt resonance, like on a cellular level. And I was sitting at a bonfire, but it was like, we're all just sitting around the fire and no one's more than, and no one's less than.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like this whole world is that. So this whole idea there of hierarchy is an illusion that is fundamentally at odds and antithetical to the reality of the thing that this is.
Yeah.
And so if I am buying into that dynamic and I'm trying, then I will by definition feel a chasm at some level in my being. And it's interesting, a lot of the work that I do in my coaching space, for whatever reason, tends to be people coming out of the air quotes successful expression of that journey and going like, holy fuck. there's still something missing that wasn't it in the deepest sense of fulfillment. Mm. And at some level, it feels like, and I don't mean this to sound sort of, what's the word, like complacent or like whatever, but that like being in, when we truly know ourselves as essence, and I use that word intentionally, so I'm not loading it with different things that mean different things to different people, like self and non-self and et cetera. But like just when we come into relationship with essence, that unto itself is fulfilling. And then it feels like we don't burden the personality self with the task of going to try to find and create fulfillment through these external means, but it is almost as though the innate fulfillment overflows, and the overflow is our actions, our relationships, our creations, etc. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, that's so beautiful. And also brings me back to the tragedy in some ways of our culture, not to be super negative, but I mean, just thinking about capitalism, like we have to survive. So in some ways it feels weird to say it like this, but it's in some ways it feels like a privilege to be able to look inward in a culture that tells us we have to go fast to survive.
Mm-hmm. Just want to take that in.
Yeah.
I think this gets to the heart of like what feels like suffering in like the private sense for so many of us. Mm-hmm. My next podcast, I'm going to interview someone that hosts men's groups and does specifically men's work. And I feel like I'm just so excited to get into this because it just feels like it's like a struggle that's traveled with me through most of this journey. And I have two children, one boy, one girl. My son is about to be 19 in a few days, and my daughter just turned 14. And so they're emerging consciousness in all these spaces, and it's like treading so sensitively and tenderly to these spaces of not, you know, wanting to impose those conditions. You know, my daughter, you know, is 14 years old. We're driving to school, and she shares with me that she's nervous to become an adult. She's nervous to become an adult. I mean, like, do you mean like going into high school next year? And she's like, no, like after that. And my heart sunk because I can remember being her age and having the same stress, anxiety response of what am I going to do with my life, but not being able to do anything with that because you're not at that point yet. So if you train anything, it's the futurizing attachments to outcomes that aren't even available for us to work with. And the tool that we worked with in that moment, other than like some somatic ones, was like always kind of good. I would love to get into this with you too, but like somatic first to like bring us online, but then exploring a little bit of the insight. And so I asked her, you know, when she was going to be at that point, when that was going to be a relevant situation for her. And so she went, she did high school and she did college. She's like probably about 23. And I was like, okay, 23. And how old are you? And she's 14. And I'm like, so what's 23 minus 14? And she's like, 9. Okay, perfect. So now let's do this and let's just test out the theory a little bit. If we were to do 14 minus 9, how old would you be? And she's like, 5. And I'm like, what grade? She's like, kindergarten. Okay, so now imagine that you're in this moment right now and you have some choices to make about life that are relevant to a 14-year-old. Like, what classes do you want to pick for next year? Do you want your kindergartner picking them? And she's like, no. You know, and your 23-year-old self is not going to want to hear the opinion of your 14-year-old self. So instead of being burdened and consumed and wondering about that time, know that you're going to continue to grow and evolve and come into new things that you love and are interested in. And that version of you is going to be so much more prepared and equipped and available to answer those questions. And you're free to be a kid. You know, just be a kid. Don't let that steal and rob this from you. And I was so grateful, Tani, to like have the conversation because I think the first thing I shared with her was like, I so get where you are, that this is traveling with me the whole time. And it's like, when are we going to air it out? And yes, I believe in free market capitalism in the sense that that's great that there's opportunity, but man, it does feel like that survival anxiety can be intense.
Yeah. I am struck that a 14-year-old girl went to her dad, you, to talk about this. Like, that's amazing. That's so amazing. And I also, what's coming up for me is how important somatics are, but also you seem like you approach that first with empathy, but then from a top-down approach, which is also incredibly necessary. Like, hold on, like, let's look at the facts and the logic of this, you know, and how soothing that can be to our systems too. And I hope it was. I imagine it was for her.
Yeah, she I checked in with her after school and she's like, it was a good day. And like it's awesome that offered relief. Yeah, going back to Enneagram, there's a big piece of it that is on conflict resolution styles. And there's three primary, and one of them is emotional realism. One of them is logical rational, and one of them is it's called positive outlook, but I really think of it as like reharmonization.
And
And
that's just to clarify, or maybe you're already about to say this, but is this within each Enneagram number, there's those three options for conflict resolution?
the short answer is yes and no.
Okay.
There'll be a dominant one of the three. So
Oh,
within
okay.
the nine types, you've got those three conflict resolution styles cross-referenced against three strategies for how we get our needs met, which is by through means of becoming assertive, withdrawn, or dutiful. So the combinations of those things, those three times three equals
Yeah.
nine, and that's the basic like substrate of the personality.
Interesting.
And then personality is deemed as the learned self and like the ego identity that we might carry that's formed. Actually, this is a question I have for you. It's like in the Enneagram structure, personality is an evolutionary iteration of impressions that get lodged through life. And so if I have experienced a wound and then I generate a nervous system response, a belief about myself or the world through it, then I begin to interpret life through the contours of those imprints. And so then I start to essentially assign personality with the function of looking for the thing that I thought I lost, but that I actually didn't. But if I can identify what that is, it tells me what to look for, but within myself rather than the attachment
Outside.
or aversion to finding it or not finding it in
Yeah.
the material world.
Oh, that's really fascinating. I've never heard it Enneagram explained in that way, and that makes me feel more interested in it.
Yeah, because it has become also one of those pop psychology things. And like most things, I think it can get the depth can get lost or missed.
It seems
So,
hard for me to grasp how it can just be one, but yeah.
what could be one?
How we could just be one number.
Oh yeah, that's another misconception is that we're not.
Oh.
So
Oh.
the premise is that like all nine types live within all of us, but we have a center of gravity, if you will. So just similar to attachment theory, I think that maybe I have I'm predominantly anxious attached, but like you were saying earlier, there are times when I might go avoid it, and so you want to do your work in all your types, but know where your central tendencies live. And then of course, when each number has a number on each side of it, so it's your wings and those infuse, and then the stress and the integration currents bring other numbers in. So, and then when you start, if you really bring in like the yogic consciousness that we're that what is reincarnating, if you hold reincarnation as a metaphysical position, then the samskaras or the imprints are what's generating the perpetuation of karma. And so it, and that's kind of like where the Hindu and the Buddhist schools have some element of alliance in the sense, because you have to think, well, from a Buddhist view, if there's no self, what's reincarnating? And And so the idea is like, well, it's actually this, the they call it the mind stream, and it's essentially the karmic aggregate of these imprints or these samskaras. So if that's true, then it's actually the personalities that are reincarnating. And if that's true, then you're not just the one that you happen to be dominant in this life, but you're going to have that be informed by, well, maybe in a prior life you were this personality, and the karmic accumulation of those tendencies as personality propensities are going to show up here too. And so I think that's why it's, to me, it's so important that we do our work in all the spaces, and mostly not to limit our identity to, something like I am back to the I'm a five, I'm a four kind of thing.
Oh, that's
But
so fun and terrifying at the same time.
I right. I would love to talk about just the experience of somatic tools themselves. We feel like we've danced around it a little bit. So not danced around it, but like mentioned it in passing. So do you have certain like go-tos or favorite things that you could offer people that are listening that that might be some simple practices to implement if they're feeling any sort of nervous system dysregulation?
I mean, I think that practices said without any sort of shaming behind it, but I just feel like in general, what I've noticed is that practices, when they're more of a consistent basis, can help us sometimes maybe more than when in a very dysregulated space, because it becomes more of that, similar to maybe meditation, becomes more of an ingrained practice that can help us loosen things a little bit easier than if we're just doing it when we're dysregulated. Not that I heard you saying that, but just as an offering.
Yes, thank you for that.
And one of them is, if you feel open to your senses, if there's something that you can sense into, literally, if that's a channel that you have relationship with, then the five senses can be a great place. And in fact, I have specific memories of doing yoga as a younger teenager, and for the first time in my life, for what it felt like actually feeling all of myself, like having that interoceptive awareness. And that was very helpful for me to feel here, because if you tend to dissociate, then obviously you don't, or maybe not so obviously, you don't feel your senses. So just simply coming to the five senses of, what is it that I can touch in this moment? What is it that I can listen to or hear? Just taking a moment, like maybe even birds or a train far away. What is it that I can smell, and taking a moment with that? Eating something or seeing if there's a taste in your mouth. What is it that I can see? So really just engaging the senses, as if, if an alien consciousness would just flop into your body right now and experiencing humanness for the first time, what would it sound, taste, smell, hear, see like? So that's something that can be helpful. And then also, sometimes the senses are not necessarily a channel that is easy for somebody or safe feeling, just like relationships. So there's this concept in somatic experiencing called Cybam, and the S is sensation, but there's other letters too. So I is imagery. In my experience of you, Scott, it seems like imagery is very evocative for you, or a place that you go to, maybe a relationship that you have. Maybe I'm projecting that, but you've said a few things.
No, yeah, you pegged me.
Me too. I feel like it can be a great place for anybody that might be listening that's interested to a book that's really amazing that utilizes imagery and attachment that I love, and that I just had my first training in, is called Body Dreaming. And Marian Denlia fuses depth psychology and attachment and imagery together, an act of imagination, in
Oh,
a really
cool.
beautiful way. And then, so just following the letters of that word that I mentioned from somatic experiencing, Cybam, the B is behavior. So maybe that's the actual behavior that's happening in this moment. It could also be how I just moved my arms. Like just slowing that down and noticing, oh, what could be there in this moment? There's this behavior that came up. What happens if I really notice it and take a moment with it and just really engaging with whatever, like just really noticing or imagining that everything that's happening is data. Even this movement right here, like that could be behavior to look at and be with and get curious about and see if there's something else there. And then there's A, which is affect, which is really just feeling and emotion. So to somatically be with that, like even curiously, like I think that I'm angry, but actually, if I sit with it, there's tension in my chest. So there's anger here, but also maybe for more of a Vipassana view, but also somatic experiencing can be like this too. If I kind of tease away, like the anger, it's important to realize, to acknowledge that. It helps, like naming it to tame, can help tame it sometimes. But also it can sometimes, I think, keep us stuck there too. So there's also just the sensation. What happens when we notice it as sensation? What happens when we notice it, like getting down, if we can, from there? And if we can't, then just the emotion is great too. Feelings wheels, like if you want to put one on the back of your phone or on your fridge, we have such a limited vocabulary for feelings. And me too, I have to come back to that wheel often because it just can become in somatic work, what we call it is overcoupled, where things are just kind of tangled and smushed together. So if we can name one thing, then we get to untangle that experience and there's more spaciousness inside. So we're not all just like a fiery hot ball of mess, but we can kind of get an idea of what's happening inside. And then the last one is meaning. So the meaning that I'm making, I can kind of, if I'm in a state all day where everybody fucking sucks, like that's sort of the head frame that I'm in, then I can track it to, oh, well, I'm probably in a fight right now. Probably in a fight, like I might be, right? So let me get curious about that. Am I feeling hyper aroused? Am I easily agitated? And that's really fun and interesting to look at too, because that can give us some distance from our thoughts, but also because if I'm in that fight place, sometimes that could also be depression, right? Like if I'm agitated, sometimes that could be me noticing I'm feeling really sad. I, me personally, Tawny, I will sometimes be mad at my sad. So anger can be, fight can be the first response, but it's actually the easiest response for me through my conditioning. So then the harder, softer response would be to notice, oh, there's sadness underneath.
Yes, it's the emotional literacy in all of this is incredible. It's and we in our trainings we have these like popsicle sticks with index cards glued to them, and each one says same on it. So whenever somebody shares something, if we agree, we hold it up and we're like same stick. And if it's in like group text, people just like type in same stick. And
I love that.
yeah, so I'm like same sticking you right now and the recognition to go. And this actually is interesting because this goes into the Enneagram piece of our reactive patternings as well, of like that piece of going, I know I go to angry first, being in the triad that my type lives in, but I know enough to know that that instinctive mad instinctive, this is, it's typically around something like that feels unjust. And if yeah, for,
Yeah, I'm like, are we the same thing? I
maybe there's
hear
other archetypes, but it's for our listeners, that was a scrunchy face. If
you.
you're not viewing this podcast. So yes, it's like knowing enough to know that that's the instinctive reaction, but beneath that there's hurting. And then from hurt, yeah, I can go, okay, so what is this? And I love the feelings wheel. It's awesome. I like to use that in coaching too as an opening. Where are we? Where are we starting from today? This is, and we can start to put these words to just a simple act of having syntax for emotion. The other one I found that's super helpful is a scale. So even if like in my relationship, if we're like moving about the cabin of life, and between us there's five children and there's three dogs and there's respective practices and training, all these things, so it's a lot of times it's on the fly, it can be helpful to say, to start the conversation of like, one is grounded, and five is, I am in the torrent of it all. We could even just do a voice text like, I'm at a three right now, I'm at a two, so we know where we're meeting each other from. So having some kind of a shorthand is super, super powerful. But I really love this. So
I'm gonna
just
steal
for a quick
that.
review, say
I'm gonna steal that. I love it.
yeah, the other one I'll give you that's similar to kind of something you were saying earlier. I had recently made a little reel about this, but was like, record a voice note to your triggered self. It's really, really powerful, because when we're in that, we are so invested in the story that we're having, like, I'm angry, or I'm being blamed, or I'm upset. And then it's interesting that in these triggered moments, our brains are incapable of nuance, and we feel called to make big decisions. So like, I'm out, or will you marry me? But whoa, like, you were just out a second. It's like, whoa, like these big things start coming from these really like reactive and tumultuous energies. And it's like learning, like, don't make big decisions from heightened reactive spaces. If it's a big decision, it's worth doing it from that clear, grounded state. So, but because that version of us feels so compelled towards choice making, can I hear, there's something about hearing my own voice enter in that disrupts the pattern. So it's not just necessarily like, okay, I'm gonna like go on Tani's Instagram and see if there's some like soothing words of wisdom, but like, which is also awesome. But to be like, hey, it's me, as in you, but probably the you're going to arrive at in like whatever it is for you. Are you a 3-dayer? Are you a 3-hour? What does your resilience window look like? I tend to operate with the sense of like, are we rubber banding, or are we taffying? Like, taffying means like it takes us a while to come back. Rubber band is a pretty quick one. But so I might say like, so if you're taffying out right now, know that you're okay. This is me speaking to you and from your ground. And this is why you're feeling this way. You might be interpreting it like this. It might not actually be true, but it does make sense and it's valid. And if I can do that for myself, there's something unique about it going like, wow, this is actually the wise version of me coming into the triggered experience. And it's like, wow.
I really appreciate you sharing that. And there's been a couple of things that you've shared today that just re that seem related to that, like your own wise self nurturing your reactive and triggered self, that reminds me of that ideal parent figure protocol visualization that I think I briefly mentioned earlier, that Daniel P. Brown and David Elliott were doing it at Harvard, and David Elliott's still doing it. Anyway, it's really cool though, because there's research behind it too, if you're into that, of how visualizing ideal parents, which it sounds like you kind of become your ideal parent in a way, soothing the reactive parts in us that never got the soothing that it needed, helps us actually rewire our attachment.
Wow. I saw this on your website in doing research for our podcast, this internalizing the ideal parent. And so can you speak a little bit more about that?
So, I mean, again, like different modalities or different traditions in psychology, and then also, in yoga and whatever else, do some sort of reparenting, it seems. But in this tradition, through these two people, they have an ideal parent figure protocol meditation, basically, that has you bring in a felt sense that you had as a child or any time in your life, but usually when you're a child, that never got soothed. that never was seen, that was never valued, that was never comforted, that was never seen in a way. And similar to how you're speaking to the Enneagram, actually, maybe searching for that in other people or feeling like it's you're never going to receive it, or that there's some huge divine flaw in you or whatever. And then imagining that an ideal set of parents or parent or whatever can see it and soothe you in exactly the way that you need it to be. And then you do that often. And it's one part of pillars of becoming secure. And the other part is mentalizing, which we've been talking about today, like imagining what it's like for the other person, panning out and seeing the whole situation. So the things we're doing, but the practice is continuing to do them.
It's really incredible. I'm wondering if on that same thread, but bringing it out more from the imagining and the mentalizing piece to a modality like, have you worked with psychodrama at all?
I have never
Familiar?
been trained in psychodrama, but I don't know exactly. Yeah, could you say more about what psychodrama means to you, or yeah,
Yeah,
what
and
it
I'm
is?
not the expert to talk about this, but my partner is trained in it, and she's wow, like an incredible space holder for this. And so I have witnessed it and learned from that. So let me just be clear in that. But it's very powerful. It's a similar process of what is the need that I had that went unmet? What was the experience I need to have that I didn't? What was the thing I needed to say that I couldn't? And then actually getting to and receiving back that piece. And so in a sense, you're like acting it out. And the way I understand it from the complete picture is like there's actually like the facilitators, like a director, and you're essentially guiding it like it's almost like a play, right? But you're playing out the experience that you needed to have. And the rewiring that occurs is really, really beautiful. And I think for the times when maybe that human being, like if that human being is there where there's like opportunity for repair, that's incredible. But so often it's like that person's not in our life, or that person is deceased, or they're not available in terms of
Absolutely.
capacity for that kind of a conversation. It can be really powerful. But yeah, so
That's
something for our
powerful.
listeners and viewers to check out. I want to go back to something that you said though in when we were talking about some of the somatics and the Cybam and that piece, you mentioned interoception. And I wanted to go back to that piece for people that might not be familiar with that word and how interoception is different than maybe like cognitive behavioral therapy. And just kind of how, as a therapist, you see what that means and how people might bring that into their, like, I guess it would almost be like their zeitgeist of understanding healing work.
So I imagine a lot about interoception, because it's my understanding of it is feeling the inside of ourselves, our spatial inwardness. And so it's really taken from movement and being able to, if I don't move my hand, how can I sense that my hand is there? That kind of experience there. If I don't move my feet, how can I sense that my feet is there? It's feeling all of myself, which can help us to really know what our boundaries are and what we're feeling. But it can also help us know our neuroception, which is, am I being threatened or not? Am I in danger or not? So if we're looking at it from a somatic lens or a polyvagal lens, then if I'm threatened, I might be in more of a fight flight stage. And I could just be going around constantly being threatened. And if I don't have that interoceptive inward awareness in any way that I can, whether through sensation or noticing thoughts or just even the images that are evoked in me naturally, then I could just be in that reactive place, not knowing what's actually happening. Like potentially, if I'm in fight flight, it's because I have this neuroception that there's danger around me, that I'm not safe. And so to come into a place of ventral, which would be in our window of tolerance, we're feeling safe, we're feeling social, we're feeling playful. Maybe, we can sense our breathing, we can hear more, we can notice things around us. That's different than cognitive behavioral therapy because I guess it's just noticing the state more than cognitive behavioral therapy is. I'm not trained in cognitive behavioral therapy, but as far my awareness or training around it, the class that I've had and the experiences of it is thinking about your thoughts, noticing when there's cognitive distortions, which is all really wonderful and necessary. And there's the body component that I find to be really interesting too, to see, well, where are those thoughts being formulated from? What physiological state is that coming from? And does that need to be kind of moved through and noticed?
This is so fascinating to me, and I'd love to into it a little bit more if so. When I was first learning some of the Eastern modalities that were not as body based, there was this idea that the sequence goes from stimulus to interpretation to emotion, or like reaction to behavior or action. And this research is showing something a little bit different than that, which is, I mean, I guess it depends how we define the word interpretation. If we define interpretation as a primarily mental perceptive process, then it seems that maybe we're missing something, but that the insight of interoception is that we're actually having an instinctive nervous system interpretation prior to having a cognitive one. And that when information flows body to brain rather than brain to body, and that our capacity to be in attunement to the body, as you're describing, is so vital, because as we know, in those heightened amygdala responses, like the brain's capacity to sort out the information, as we're talking about, when you're activated in some way or dysregulated in some ways, severely impacted. And so having body-based tools is so essential in terms of this. So that's kind of why I was asking from the interoception standpoint, is like how valuable that is to not go around the physical, but to move really from it. But then I start to also think about, and this is where my curiosity is living currently with it, is that makes a lot of sense to me when I'm in a traumatized state or even in a triggered state. But when I'm regulated, when I'm just in, healthy functioning process, however you want to describe, I'm probably not using the right words right now, that there's a sense of, it does feel like if you and I are having this conversation, that I am processing what you're saying cognitively, and then I'm having some sort of a reaction to my interpretation, and then words come out of my mouth. So it seems like maybe they're not in conflict with each other, but within different contexts, the sequence maybe flows differently. And again, I kind of approach this with intellectual humility. I feel like more like I'm in the curiosity phase of it, but I wondered if you had thoughts on that.
I mean, I have thoughts on it because I'm also curious. All of this, like even polyvagal theory and the idea that the body holds a score and means also in a very positive way too, they're all just theories. And there's also pushback on it too. So
Can you say more about that?
I mean, I need to educate myself more on the pushback. But I know, for instance, like Dr. Lisa Feldman Barrett has written about the myth of the triune brain, that the new neuroscience is that we actually, when we're in a reactive space, we don't go to the lizard brain in such a clear black and white way as we've been taught. And so
I've
there's
heard this
new.
as well. It's like the is it like the what is it the I forget the name of the aspect of the brain, but it's more forward.
The prefrontal
The
cortex.
yeah, the, it's like there's something. There was like one other aspect above it before prefrontal. Like, is it the cingulate prefrontal cortex or something? Some
Prefrontal
aspect of the
singular? I'm not
prefrontal
sure.
cingulate. Yeah, I'm not a brain, not a neuroscientist.
I'm
Although
not a
in 2 weeks we'll
neuroscientist
be talking
either.
to a neuroscientist, so we can ask him
Nice.
this.
Ask him. Yeah, please ask him about the trying brain.
Yeah, I think
Yeah.
it's the cingulate prefrontal or pre something, but it's yeah, it's not that it's not even like that we're. That it's like our hippocampus to our amygdala, that there's like another piece specifically where trauma lives.
Oh, the limbic system, maybe. Yeah, because I
It,
know our
yeah.
memories are, when it comes to trauma, are stored in a very particular way. That's trauma researchers are explaining. That's much different than how we've come to know memory, and that's why a lot of times when there is trauma or even neurodivergency and dissociation, memories are not really there because they're more associated with emotion. Memories. There needs to be an emotion to be able
Yeah.
to go into the long-term memory. It's really fascinating. Mary Catherine McDonald is a researcher that wrote a book recently about trauma where she talks about memory. I haven't read the book yet, but I know her a bit. And anyway, there's a lot here.
I think it's the posterior cingulate
Cortex.
cortex.
Okay. Yeah. And that's where the trauma is stored.
I think it's where it's stored and then gets activated. I could be wrong, but for our listeners,
Yeah.
to if you're interested in checking that out, the
Yeah.
PC.
It is really fascinating. But, so it's important to know the science. And also, when the science changes, it's also interesting because, from my understanding, science isn't really updated in universities for 10 to 20 years just because of how long it takes. For things, I don't know if that's what I've read. I don't know how true that is, but it definitely seems like there's a lag. But sort of that aside, I think the experiential is important too. And it's interesting. When you were speaking, I had a memory come up this past week where I was in a really triggered space, and I tried everything that I could somatically to shift me out of it, and nothing was working. And what actually did was journaling about my worst fears, about what I was having anxiety and dysregulation around, and then I was able to breathe and feel more calm. So I think it's a both and. And also, just to push back even further, journaling and imagining is somatic in some way.
Yeah, I'm smiling, which is why I'm smiling. I'm not smiling that you're gonna get out of your chair. I'm smiling because I'm about to say
It did
the
eventually. Yeah.
same. Yeah, yeah. That's what, like almost everything I've ever written was like a journal entry to myself. You know, to
Hell yeah.
it is my therapy. So I deeply resonate with it, and it is how I'll know when I am that way. I just start writing and writing and write, and I'll let everything speak, the anger, the sadness, the
Let it
it'll
out.
sound blaming and all of it, and but I'll sort it out. I'll feel like it gets to move, and for whatever reason, that's the medium that works for this being. And
Yeah.
so yes, so there's something about the recognition that this is not a one size fits all kind of
Yeah.
thing. That's not what healing is, that it's going to take some exploration. It's going to take some, trial by fire. It's going to get messy. It doesn't have to be perfect. And what is that anyway?
That's right.
And
Yeah.
ultimately it's like our humanness. It's just, we're figuring out how to human, to use it as a verb.
Yeah.
And that feels it's wild because so much of what we're experiencing is this inherited, neurobiology
Yeah.
over, hundreds of thousands of years of, at least 200,000 for Homo sapiens sapien, which again, going back to theory, do we even know what we are, where we came from? I mean, that could be
I
a whole
know,
rabbit
right?
hole,
Yeah.
different episode. But, you know, given that we are somewhat blindfolded to understand ourselves and what our deeper structures and patterning is, and in the realm of relationship, that we get to figure it out together. And that's so incredibly beautiful. I'm so grateful for humans that feel called to be with other humans in this work. And so that's my next question for you is, so kind of getting under the hood a little bit of the journey of being a space holder. If you could speak to other space holders, whether they are therapists, you know, coaches, meditation teachers, yoga teachers, etc., what are a couple of gems of yours that, or maybe even, and here I'm going to challenge you if that's okay.
Okay.
What have been some of your greatest challenges that have then been alchemized into those gems?
Okay. First, I just realized that I'm at 3%. Do you mind if I go run to get a charger really quick?
No, that's great. Yeah.
It'll take me 1 second. Thank you. Or it will take me 30 seconds. Be right back. Thank you.
Bye. All right.
So we can begin with the first one, and that one of my biggest challenges has been that I have ADHD. I'm just going to plug this in. And it's, you know, a joke, but it's also been really challenging in some ways because, especially as, or I don't know if I should say especially, but as a woman, I feel like it can show up differently, or it is, there's been research to show that it can show up differently. And so throughout my life, from the time I was young, I just thought I was really unintelligent. And that there's something really wrong with me. And so there was a lot of shame attributed to the way that my brain works and the way that I am as a human. And I have a lot of, thank you. Yeah. I have a lot of neurodivergent clients, and I feel like also neurodivergent people just flock to me or something, not really to me, but you know, we tend to find ourselves in groups with one another. And so there's a kind of kinship in it. But there also can be a challenge. And I think what's been really helpful for me is to recognize the superpowers and gifts that can come from it. Mm-hmm. And I would want to, and I want to, not just would want to, encourage anyone to see what might not feel like a strength in a different way. Like if you're partner or your best friend or a mentor of yours had these kinds of traits, what could be the really wonderful things about finding patterns and everything and getting super excited and hyper fixated and just kind of also allowing the grief to be there too.
It's like that has somehow become your superpower.
ADHD.
Yeah, and the neurodivergence, and it's like cultivates the sensitivity and the capacity and the wherewithal to be with people that are moving through that, and the capacity to see things through a non-conventional lens because of the way your brain works. And it's funny, I had this conversation yesterday with my partner. We were reading this book. It's called the Viveka Chudamani, and it's a ancient text, but 1200 years old. And it was saying this really interesting thing, which was the idea that we are in bondage and need to be liberated is the illusion. Right. It's like, so if there's any idea to become free from, it's the idea that we're not already free. And she said, is it weird that I've never even had the idea that I need to become unbound? Like it's never, I don't hold it that way. I don't think about it like that since I was a little kid to now. I just don't hold it that way. And we were exploring like, well, is that neurodivergence? Is that, accumulated merit of former life work? Is it, you know, is it because we're so conditioned that it never crossed my mind to like, what is it? And kind of land on like, it's kind of cool. Like maybe what in my response to her is like, maybe what neurodivergence is the it's not neurodivergence. It's like we confuse natural and normal so often. And maybe what's normal in this society is like kind of a, like maybe that's what it is the how do we say it? Like the modified state, or that's the altered state, right? Maybe
Interesting.
the neurodivergent is the growth work that you've done. So now your brain is wiring itself around an insight that already knows you don't need to become free because you're not bound. Right. So I think maybe same, right? Like maybe same for you, the things that are like, oh, I do it differently. My brain works like this, you know? And, you know, I don't know the answer to it, but I just think like we need to hold open the possibility. So this is actually a cool lead.
No, I was just, I think that's a really sweet reframe. Like, it's a really kind and compassionate reframe. And I noticed, I guess I do have something to add. I noticed immediate, like defensiveness almost in me of like, no, that can't be true. You know? Yeah. But also just, it reminds me again of that image that you shared about, I think you were saying it was like a tantric person who is dancing wildly. And just thinking about how we've been taught and learned and conditioned of what is right to do and how to act, and like all of these ways that we mask. And when we're not wearing those masks, isn't that our true nature? And like that wildness, isn't that okay?
And who's determining what is okay and what is not okay? Which is such a perfect lead into the last piece that I wanted to get to, which is relational structures and gender identities and like monogamy and polygamy and polyamory and non-binary and like I'm throwing out a lot of terms, but all these ideas that if we had said these words 20 years ago, people would be like, I don't even know what you're saying right now. And as we strip ourselves from convention and say like this is my truth, and I do hear people push back and go, it's not, there's not your truth, there's the truth. And
That's interesting.
yeah, I think it's probably like maybe a little bit more from like a conservative standpoint. And I think it's a pushback against the idea of maybe the pendulum swings so far that it's like now society is bending to such a degree to like, so everybody's pronouns and the trans person can compete in the sporting events that, you know, and so it brings up all these issues and we're kind of going like, how do we, you know, I think we're figuring it out in real time as a society. It's like, how do we make a space where everybody feels valued? Where everybody's included, and where, how does that happen? What feels like, well, that feels unfair to this group, or now we're creating this imbalance in the name of overcoming that imbalance, and it's a tricky space. And I like my nervous system feels for the like collective trying to like watch us figure it out. And so I wondered from the standpoint of a therapist who focuses in some of these spaces, I've seen you speak to them in what you shared online. And so if there, I really was, I am looking forward to hearing, if you can spend a few more minutes, I know we're kind of towards the, our time, but maybe just briefly speak to this topic and what you've seen in your therapy practice that might be important for us as a society to understand and know and become sensitive to.
I mean, it's such a broad question that I feel like we could spend so many podcasts, maybe the rest of life, talking about. And also that's probably necessary to do is to continue to check in on what these things mean. Yeah, like the shifting containers. I think it's really interesting that people are questioning what has been reactive. And if somebody is called to that and wants to explore it, then that's wonderful. And some people aren't, and that's wonderful too. You know, like maybe they're okay being cisgender with a specific, with the, you know, their given birth as their pronoun, and they want monogamy, and they want to get married and have children, and they want it to be in a linear line that has historically looks like a relationship escalator. I don't think there's anything negative about any of that. I think that it can be incredibly liberating to be able to feel into what these external representations mean internally. So if I say, if we were to stick to just for, to make it easy, I guess, to relationship design, if I tell somebody that I'm in a monogamous relationship, then there's a lot of associations that people have, in my experience too, of people thinking that they know that I'm committed to, that I'm committing to the other person, what commitment means, that I'm chosen as a woman, things like that. And so if I take that away, then sometimes in our culture, then there's a lot of ideas about what that means too, that I'm not committed to, that maybe I have less worth, that I'm not chosen, that I'm a slut and what that means or whatever. Like there's all these really interesting biases and projections that happen that I think are really, it's been really liberating for me just to look at just the containers themselves. Like if I want commitment, if I want monogamy, what does that actually mean? That I want security, which I do. And what does that actually mean? And just continuing to follow that thread, really to find that security within myself. And then to be able to speak more clearly to the needs that I have. Because I think what's coming up, and I don't know if you've had this experience with any conversations around containers, is the threat of what it means to create new containers. But I think that we can actually have more freedom and more security by just getting curious about what's underneath the title.
Amazing. And it opens up so many questions. And I think that would be great. The conversation that I feeling arise up within me is almost like a round table. And I would love to have something. I did something similar to this recently on the election and politics, and having people that see things through different lenses come together and have these conversations. I mean, the podcast called Healing the Divide. And I think that we can make that actually happen in real time. Mm-hmm. It would be really, really powerful, because people listening all have their stances that they're identified with. And if there's somebody that's here that feels like, wow, they're representing my voice, and we can watch how they can interact with one another, I think there's something inherently valuable in that kind of a conversation. Yeah, I think in terms of this subject matter, maybe this is a good place to park it. And because it feels like a billion.
Opening a different door. Yeah.
Yeah, it feels like we're opening Pandora's box a little bit. But I want to just check before doing that. Is there anything else you feel called to share in this particular space that feels important?
I mean, I just, maybe it's related, but not exactly to that, is that, you know, I love that your podcast is called Healing the Divide. And I just feel called to share that in my own medicine work, what's come up for me time and time again is the divide that I've experienced, either in client work or in the world and intergenerationally between men and women. Specifically, and maybe we could call it the feminine and masculine, and the wounds there, the harm, the pain, the suffering, and how my hope is that really, like, I know that's even a part of my bio, but my hope is that loving relationships can really heal the hatred and shame and protection between the divide.
I love that so much. And it's funny because I call the podcast Healing the Divide, but I don't believe that divide exists in a fundamental sense. But I believe that because we operate from identification with particular aspects of experience, we act as if we're divided, and then we project and proliferate that consciousness. And it's funny, the one thing on my list that I didn't get to as a talking point was notions of divine masculine and feminine, and how they don't only exist in terms of our, whether it's men and women,
Gender,
gender, any of the gender notions, but like even the principles archetypally live within us. And how, for example, my like divine feminine wants to like express the various emotions that I'm moving through, but my divine masculine gives me the container to hold them, and how. And when I can integrate those aspects within my own self, when they show up around me, I have greater capacity to recognize, oh, well, if heavy emotion is moving like waves, I can be like the ground that sits beneath it. It's like the ground knows it's not the waves, but it doesn't say no to them either. The sky knows it's not the clouds that are passing through, but it doesn't say no to them either. And I think finding that capacity for being with something without being something or being threatened by something feels like it's such a through line in a lot of the places our conversation has traveled. And that brings me back to the value and importance and necessity, really, to connect to our own ground. And from there, what's possible? And it's not just the moving from dysregulation to regulation, as we were talking about before the podcast, but from regulation up into liberation. And it's a whole other series of podcasts we didn't really get to get into, is like the dark and the philosophy and it.
And that sounds like an exciting conversation too. And I just know, like, I have a lot of pushback on the feminine and masculine language
Well, it's
too.
so funny because so that's the part of this was my question for you is, do you think of it in these terms? And if you don't, what is that? Like, how do you, can you give the quick snapshot version?
It sounds black and white. I'm going to explain it, but here's the quick is I've had an issue with the divine feminine, divine masculine language for a long time because I actually wonder if it keeps us in a system based on patriarchy, basically, of seeing men and masculinity as one way and seeing women and femininity in one way, whether or not it's gender, there's still going to be the biases and they're loaded terms. And also, with respect to the traditions that brought in the idea of masculine and feminine, who says there's just two energies? Is there not a multiplicity? And I know that some of the most tender energies in my life have actually been in male bodies. And, I don't know that I would call it feminine either. So I think, it's hard to say it succinctly, but I just, ha yeah, I wonder how else to talk about
Thank you. Yeah, and
it.
this is like the feeling of growth and that I'm having in me right now. And I love it. And it's funny, I heard myself say to someone last week, I don't like this terminology, and I find myself continuing to utilize it at times because I don't have other words to put in. And yet this is exactly what we're talking about, is pushing back against conventions, norms, but also new things that we're learning and not falling into the, again, this is like the colonization of consciousness. It's just, yet we need syntax and language to talk about it. And it's okay. And it doesn't have to be perfect, don't have to work always. We can be in the real time figuring it out, but I'm so grateful for that pushback. I want to share that. And I'm grateful for that you're leaving me on the note of curiosity. Like, I'm so excited to go explore. I love words a lot. They feel medicinal to me. So I'm grateful for the invitation to search for words that feel in resonance and also that can be shared. And not that we're responsible for what, may or may not sit well with somebody else, but in ways that can invite more inclusivity into a dialogue so we can get past the loaded and get into what's underneath. Like you were saying, what you're doing underneath these words and these titles is like, oh, I'm looking for connection and security. Okay, so how do we get there? And what are the ways of not just speaking about it, but thinking about it that still have room for evolution? And if we can interpret that need not with, as criticism for, oh, I can't believe I've been doing that, and self-shame, but go, oh, cool, this is an opportunity to grow in a new way. I love how that feels.
Yeah.
And the insight, not as an opportunity to beat ourselves up, but to lift ourselves up.
Mm-hmm.
And we can turn our pattern recognition work into profound momentum. And I hope that's what comes of this conversation for people that tune into. And I hope that's the ripple that we generate.
Mm-hmm. Well, so I just had an image of cracking eggs, like growing out of eggs.
Yeah, that's how it works, right? And yeah. Well, thank you so much, Connie, for taking the time today, for the trust that you've extended to me, and having never met in person, if this counts as in person, but even virtually, other than following pages and recognition for the work that you do. Thank you for the trust to go into a shared container for an extended period of time.
Yeah.
Like this.
You're welcome. Thank you. Thank you so much. You're so easy to talk with.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, thank you so much. Likewise. And thank you, everybody, for listening and tuning in today. I hope that this podcast has opened up a lot of curiosity, new ways of thinking about things, maybe learning some new tools, but mostly just bringing curiosity and warmth and kindness to your journey and to each other's journey, too.
Mm-hmm.
Take care. Thank you again, Tani. And catch you guys next time.
Okay.